Show. Let me thank our guests. We had journalists from the Behind the Headlines, Dan Cohen from Washington, D.C., and journalist and political analyst Oli Vargas, who joined us from Cochabamba in Bolivia.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون جنا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Scotland votes in a first post-Brexit election that has the potential to rock the United Kingdom over a new independence referendum. Israeli forces arrest several Palestinians during the fourth straight night of protests against the regime's new eviction orders in East Jerusalem. And also, India sees new daily records in its COVID-19 infections and deaths, registering over 410,000 cases and nearly 4,000 fatalities in the past 24 hours. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is the World News. Our top story: polls have opened in the Scottish parliamentary elections, and results of which could impact on whether or not there is a second referendum on the region's independence from the UK. A record number of Scots have already cast their ballots, with more than 1 million having registered to vote by post. The pro-independence Scottish National Party, SNP, is seeking a majority in 129-member parliament. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has pledged to call another independence vote if her party gets a clear mandate. On Tuesday, Sturgeon challenged British Prime Minister Johnson to take the matter to court if he wants to prevent another referendum. In 2014, Scots voted by 55% to 45% to stay in the UK, but the public opinion has changed gradually after Brexit. Said Puruza is joining us now from Edinburgh to tell us more about the Scottish parliamentary election. Said, what's on the line here?
We're outside a polling station in the capital city, in one of the 72 constituencies across the country that will be casting their ballots in this historic election, to borrow a phrase from the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon. This is the sixth election in the history of Holyrood, the Scottish Parliament. The parties vying for power, the SNP, the Scottish National Party, headed by Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister, along with two other pro-independence parties, the Scottish Greens, as well as the newly formed party of ALBA, by the former First Minister, Alex Salmond. Those trying to unseat Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP, the runners-up in the previous election, the Scottish Conservatives, or the Tories, followed by Labour and Liberal Democrats. The issues that are of importance to the voters in this election: health, education, child poverty, the economy, reaccession into the EU, and on top of it all, crucially, the issue of whether or not there should be a second referendum on the Scottish independence. And that is really something that's been dominating the campaign. The pro and anti referendum parties have found middle ground on a lot of the other issues, but have been clashing up to the very last moment of campaigning on the referendum, the question of referendum. As you reported earlier, if the SNP manages to win a majority, they have a 60-seat minority in the parliament now, Nicola Sturgeon at the head of a minority government at the moment, but if they go past the 65 threshold for a majority, then the question of whether or not there will be a referendum will become inevitable, for which, as you reported, she will have to have the consent of the UK Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who has already called it irresponsible and out of the question, but we'll have to see if that will come to pass. But the impact of the pandemic is already evident at the polling station, at least in the one we're at the moment. A lot of the Scots have opted for the mail-in system. They've already cast their ballots, and the rest of the people will be exercising their democratic right in the coming hours, up to 10 p.m. That's when the polls will close. The question of when the results will come out, we're expecting that to happen due to the extraordinary circumstances that this election is being held over the course of the weekend. Bardia.
All right, thanks a lot, Saeed Puruza, for joining us from Edinburgh. Hopefully we'll be hearing from you later on in the day as well. Moving on, Palestinians have gathered in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds to protest against the Israeli regime's new eviction order for inhabitants in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Troops clashed with protesters and used water cannon to disperse them. They also arrested and blindfolded a number of protesters. Several protesters were also injured. This was the fourth consecutive night of protests against the expulsion order for Palestinians. An Israeli court ruled that over a dozen Palestinian families must leave their homes by Saturday, despite having lived in Sheikh Jarrah for generations. Palestinians see the move as part of Israel's land grab policy to expand its settlements and change the demographic character of Jerusalem al-Quds. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil says the Israeli regime is planning to evict more Palestinians from their homes despite ongoing protests against the move.
A number of Palestinian families had been kicked out by force in 2007 and in 2009. Last Sunday there was a hearing. However, the Israeli court postponed it till today, Thursday, saying that those four Palestinian families must reach a final agreement with the Israeli settler company whether to reach any compromise to leave the homes. However, the Palestinian families insisted that they will not accept any compromise with the Israeli settlers. They have been protesting on a daily basis since Sunday, and the settler groups were also gathering around the homes, clashing with the Palestinians living there. Today, there will be another hearing for four Palestinian families. On Saturday also, there will be another hearing ordering other seven Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah to leave their homes.
Senior officials and religious figures from across the Muslim world have delivered speeches ahead of International Quds Day, which is marked by rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people. They hailed the Palestinians' resistance in the face of Israeli occupation and aggression.
Al-Quds is the center of the nation. Everyone should rise. Everyone should say no to the occupiers or to the aggressors, that no one should touch Al-Aqsa or Al-Quds, which is a political capital for the state of Palestine. It is the capital of the faithful heart. hopes, eyes, hearts, and also center of conflict and struggle in the heart of the land of Palestine. Despite all the attempts that the Zionist enemy is doing, and the attempts of the United States and many countries in the world, the Palestinian people remain in a state of resistance. Today we see that the liberation of Al-Quds is closer than any day, and today I tell them that our people will remain on this land and will continue to defend this land and protect it with everything that they have, with everything that they own, and you will leave sooner or later because this is our land. This is the land of our fathers and forefathers, and you must go back to where you came from. What we see the free people in Al-Quds facing, the Zionist enemy who aims to attack the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds, they continue with their aggressive policies. This conflict today, this struggle today, this face-off is part of the path towards victory, and you will see how the faithful will come back to the mosque, to the holy sites.
The Syrian media say Israel has carried out a fresh airstrike on the province of Quneitra. According to Syrian news agencies, no damage or casualties have been reported. We were earlier joined by our correspondent Muhammad Ali for an update.
Yes, Syrian state media reported that an Israeli helicopter attacked a position in Al-Quneitra governorate just after midnight local time in Syria without inflicting any damages. Now, we still don't have any official source giving us more details here in Syria, but this is the second Israeli attack on Syria in less than 24 hours. Less than 24 hours ago, there was a wave of Israeli missile attack on various parts of Latakia countryside and, of course, Hama countryside, which killed a civilian and injured six others. We still have to wait and see if we're going to get any more details from an official military source, but definitely this is not a surprise. Israel continues to attack Syria almost every week or two, trying to undermine the Syrian army's capabilities, always striking Syrian army positions and sometimes civilian areas or industrial areas like the attack that happened yesterday. In general, Syria always sends letters to the United Nations calling on the international body to take measures to stop such Israeli attacks and to force Israel to respect the UN Charter and other state sovereignty, but yet still there is silence from the international community and Israeli strikes continue on Syria.
The Iraqi president has hailed Iran for helping in the fight against terrorism and driving out Daesh militants from the country. In an interview, Barham Saleh also honored Qasem Soleimani, stressing that the Iranian general fought beside Iraqis against terrorism during the difficult times of war. The Iraqi president also praised the bravery of the Popular Mobilization Forces, along with other branches of the Iraqi army, for their significant role in defeating Daesh and terrorism. On the issue of Tehran-Riyadh meetings, Saleh noted that Iraq has so far hosted more than one round of talks between the two sides. The president maintained that a sovereign Iraq is a common interest of the neighboring countries, and Baghdad should be a binding theme for bringing the region together. India has recorded the highest daily rise in COVID-19 cases as the country struggles to contain the deadly disease. According to the Health Ministry data, more than 412,000 people contracted the coronavirus in the past 24 hours. The total number of infections in the country has now surpassed 21 million. India also reported a record daily increase in its death toll by nearly 4,000. Coronavirus has surged in India in the past few weeks over a new variant. The country is now facing severe shortages of medicine and oxygen supplies. Several states are under localized lockdowns and curfews, but the government is reluctant to impose a national lockdown for fear of the impact on the economy. Our correspondent in New Delhi, Munawar Zaman, says India's healthcare system has collapsed and cannot deal with the huge number of patients.
So this is the second wave, and it is dangerous and deadly. But today we're getting reports that the third wave is inevitable, and it will be followed right away after the second wave. I'm not saying this. This is the scientific advisor to the government of India, who has warned that the third wave is inevitable, and it's going to be more deadlier and more tragic than the one we are facing. Now the country is facing a tremendous pressure for a complete lockdown or a national or a nationwide curfew for at least a couple or 3 weeks to at least break the transmission chain. Today's grim picture is a wake-up call. We see more than 4,000 deaths. I mean, it is absolutely chaotic, and more than 400,000 cases, which is totally out of control, and the healthcare system has collapsed. Even the foreign ministry spokesperson spoke about the healthcare system yesterday. He was not short of blaming the past governments, but he also acknowledged that the healthcare system in India has completely collapsed.
Brazilian officials report over 73,000 new confirmed COVID-19 cases, bringing the country's total closer to 15 million. Brazilian health authorities also registered over 2,800 additional fatalities from the virus. The latest figure has taken the South American nation's death toll to more than 414,000. The country remains the world's second worst hit by the pandemic in terms of fatalities after the United States. This as the total number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the U.S. has surpassed 32.5 million. American officials have also so far registered over 579,000 coronavirus deaths. The continued rise in cases and deaths in the U.S. comes despite mass vaccination programs being underway in the country. Colombian protesters have once again clashed with security forces in Bogota, marking the eighth night of anti-government demonstrations. Demonstrators threw rocks at security forces near a police station while officers responded by using tear gas to disperse the crowd. Protests, which began against a now-canceled tax reform plan, have morphed into demonstrations against the government's policies on health, education, security, and violence by police. The demonstrators are calling for universal basic income, the retraction of a health reform plan, and the disbanding of the mobile anti-disturbances squadron riot police. Meanwhile, the Colombian president has called for dialogue to address the ongoing nationwide protests.
I would like to announce that we will create a space in order to listen to the citizens and build solutions orientated toward those purposes.
Duque also noted that the Colombian government does not tolerate violence of any kind. The remarks come after the United Nations, the European Union, and the United States, as well as human rights organizations, criticized the Colombian police for excessive use of force. According to official figures, so far at least 19 people have been killed and more than 800 others injured in the ongoing demonstrations. SpaceX's Starship prototype rocket has landed safe for the first time after a series of high-altitude test flight failures. The spacecraft SN-15 blasted off from the U.S. state of Texas on Wednesday afternoon after reaching the planned altitude of 10 kilometers. It headed back to the Earth with a gentle touchdown. The 16-story rocket is being developed by Elon Musk's company to launch cargo and people on missions to the Moon and Mars. The previous test flights took off successfully but exploded either during or after landing. SpaceX's first orbital flight is planned for the end of this year. Musk says he's willing to fly Japanese billionaire Yusaka Maezawa around the moon with the Starship in 2 years. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. In this month, the faithful can connect themselves with the infinite mercy of God to get prepared for more than ever for death and the hereafter. In fact, one of the effects of fasting is to remind the individual of the hunger and thirst on the day of judgment. So, ultimately, it paves the ground for belief in that day. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, on the last Friday of Sha'ban, as he intended to make people ready for Ramadan. O people, plead to God with pure intentions and hearts to help you for fasting and recitation of the Quran. He who is deprived of God's forgiveness, indeed, his misery is complete. Do remember the thirst and hunger of the Day of Judgment. As a matter of fact, remembering the Day of Judgment removes neglect and makes one head full of the eternal life in the hereafter. Imam Reza, peace upon him, says, people have been commanded to fast in order to understand the hardship of hunger and thirst, thereby to realize the poverty and misery of the hereafter. The Prophet also says, there is a door in paradise called Rayyan. When the Day of Judgment comes, there will be heard a call, where are the fasting people? When they enter through this door, it is closed. They will be served with drinks of paradise, and anyone who drinks of them will not be thirsty anymore. Now we continue discussing atonement for the nullified fast. If a person cannot fast due to a disease and his disease continues till the next Ramadan, it is not obligatory for compensate for the days that he has failed to fast. But if a person cannot fast due to traveling, it is obligatory to compensate for the days that he has failed to fast even after the next Ramadan. In view of this, a young girl or boy who has just started fasting but is not able to fast the whole Ramadan can compensate for the days that he or she has failed to fast even after the next Ramadan. Dear friends, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, God Almighty says on every night of the month of Ramadan three times, is there any asker so that I give his demand? Is there any penitent so that I accept his penitence? Is there any seeker of forgiveness so that I forgive him? This is really a very hope-inspiring statement. So let us raise our hands on this night and appeal to God with the words of the supplication that has been narrated specially for this night. O splitter of morning and disposer of night for calm, and the sun and the moon for calculation. O Almighty, O knowing, O owner of bounty and grace and might and force and goodness and glory and nobility. O God, O compassionate, O God, O one, O God, O unique, O God, O manifest. O hidden, O living, there is no God but you. The best names, the loftiest parables, and grandeur and bounties belong to you. I ask you to bless Muhammad and his progeny and place my name on this night among the successful, and my spirit with the martyrs and my good deed at the highest point of paradise, and my evil deeds forgiven. And I plead to you to grant me certitude which accompanies with my heart and faith, which takes doubt away from me and make me satisfied with what you have distributed for me, and give us good in the world and good in the hereafter, and guard us against the punishment of burning fire, and give me a sustenance on this night, your remembrance and your gratitude, an enthusiasm toward you and returning to you and assisting me in what you have assisted Muhammad and progeny of Muhammad. Greetings to him and them.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Communique.
The Brereton Report, released in late 2020, documents alleged war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan. An inquiry into war crimes committed there by British Special Forces as well was also concluded just a few months earlier, with many similarities. This is a topic that is often overlooked and underreported, especially given the severity of the crimes. Let's take a closer look at what we learned from these inquiries. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In 2001, Australia invaded Afghanistan along with the United States and the United Kingdom. 20 years later, these countries are still occupying Afghanistan after promising they would bring peace and stability. Stupendous amounts of money, resources, and manpower have gone towards this occupation, all in the name of nation building. And as it turns out, a lot of these resources have been used to commit horrific acts against the people of Afghanistan. In late 2020, an inquiry into war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan was finally released. This 465-page report, titled the Brereton Report, was initiated in 2016 and took several years to complete. The report found that 39 Afghan civilians were alleged to have been unlawfully killed by or involving Australian Defence Force members. None of these alleged crimes took place in the heat of battle, and the victims were non-combatants or no longer combatants. The report is broken down into three parts. However, a lot of it is heavily redacted. Not just the names of individuals, but in some cases, entire events are redacted. One of the shocking practices revealed in this report is known as blooding. This practice is another extremely disturbing aspect of these war crimes. Essentially, what would happen is you'd have a platoon commander who would take a new squad member and have them execute a detained prisoner. The prisoner would be unarmed, in cuffs, and posing no threat whatsoever. The term used in this report is also of interest because they referred to this as an unlawful killing. What it really is an execution. It's cold-blooded murder. Calling it an unlawful killing is just a way to water down the horror of what we're discussing here. But you can't do that. What we're talking about here are war crimes. We're talking about murder. There is no way to sugarcoat atrocities like this. Another practice that we're also made aware of is throwdowns. Basically, what this means is that special forces would carry weapons that are not regularly issued by the Australian or British military and then plant them on a prisoner after executing them. They would throw it down on the ground next to them, a throwdown. This would make it look like the prisoner wasn't executed, but instead killed during a firefight or because they had supposedly pulled a knife, for example. None of which was true, of course. It's important to note that the Brereton Report is not in fact a criminal investigation, but an inquiry conducted by the Inspector General of the Australian Defence Force. This is a role that is separate from the chain of command in the Australian Armed Forces and is appointed by the Secretary of Defence. The Brereton Report makes a number of recommendations following the inquiry, some criminal, others promotions, others pardons. However, it's not clear which cases they're referring to because a lot of it has been redacted. Again, another war crime which didn't come from the Brereton Report but is still one of the most striking nonetheless is a video that was released by Four Corners. It shows three men from the Australian SAS chasing an Afghan farmer with a German shepherd. They catch up to him and gather around him as he is lying on the ground. At one point, one of the SAS can be heard asking if he should drop the man. There's an inaudible answer, after which we see him execute the Afghan farmer at point-blank range using his machine gun. It's sickening, it's grotesque, and it's a war crime that makes someone feel physically ill just by watching it. The man who was executed in the video was 26 years old. His name was Dad Muhammad. They said later that he was carrying a radio, supposedly, and that this proved that he was an insurgent, and that's why they killed him. This turned out to be a lie. There was no radio recovered. And even if there was, one has to ask the question, how does carrying a radio merit an execution at point-blank range? After the release of the Brereton report, a Chinese official posted a doctored image on Twitter of an Australian soldier with a knife in reference to the war crimes committed by their special forces. What's interesting here isn't so much the image, but the reaction it garnered, particularly from Australian officials. Australia's parliament was outraged by it, and Australia's prime minister issued a statement rebuking the Chinese government, demanding an apology. Apparently, the Australian government is more offended by people exposing and calling out its war crimes than the actual war crimes themselves perpetrated by its own soldiers. David McBride, a former lawyer and major in the Australian Defence Force, leaked evidence of war crimes to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ABC. After this happened, ABC's offices were raided by police. And I think it's extremely interesting and worth pointing out here that when supposedly liberal democracies like the United States, Australia, and the UK have embarrassing information about them leaked to the press, all notions of freedom of speech and press freedoms suddenly seem to go out the window. We saw this with the raid on ABC, with the persecution of Julian Assange, and numerous other whistleblowers across the years. After leaking evidence of war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan to ABC, David McBride faces 5 charges, including those of theft of Commonwealth property, breaching the Defense Act, and disclosing information without due authorization. This could result in him going to jail for decades. He joins me now to talk more. Thanks for taking the time, David. It's good to have you on.
Thank you, Richard.
So, David, I want to start out with the prosecution that you're up against. You're facing several decades in jail now because you exposed war crimes committed by the SAS in Afghanistan. You detail how you tried going up the chain of command, and they put these roadblocks and obstacles in front of you. Can you maybe elaborate on some of the mechanisms that an institution like the Australian military, perhaps the British and the American military, might put in place to prevent whistleblowers like you from disclosing the truth and exposing wrongdoing?
It wasn't war crimes that I first noticed a problem. It was more that we didn't tell the truth about anything, about small things as well as big things, that the war looked like it was being run to win domestic elections rather than to actually make a difference in Afghanistan. And I started to get suspicious because when I made complaints, they weren't treated seriously. And in fact, the message that seemed to be coming back to me was, shut up, stop making waves, what's going on is way above your pay grade. And there were some things which looked like cold-blooded murders, but that weren't being investigated, or that were just being whitewashed. And I was like, well, how can that be? How can you not look into something which looks like children are being killed?
The Brereton report, which was concluded in late 2020, says the SAS killed 39 Afghan civilians. That's the official figure. How many of those special forces that committed these murders were prosecuted or held accountable? And do you think that figure of 39 casualties is legitimate? Do you think it's accurate?
There's only one person who ever put on a uniform for Australia who was facing a trial and significant jail time at this stage, and that is me. And I think even the government finds that an uncomfortable fact. The report, as you know, was only finished late in 2020, and it wasn't a conviction of anybody. It was simply a non-criminal report, like an inquiry, which recommended charges, didn't even recommend charges, it recommended the police look at those 39 matters and, if necessary, charge people. And the wheels of justice, even when they're sort of being totally run honestly, take a long time. And it's quite possible we won't even have a trial on this until 2030. In relation to the amount of murders, I don't know that it was that many more, but it's a significant number because it wasn't, a lot of people must have known. And that's why it's truly significant, because you'd say a lot of people must have known, a lot of people must have said nothing. And not only that, what is more worrying than, say, if it had been a 300, was that often we rewarded the perpetrators of the murders. We gave them medals. We made them sort of media superstars. And I think that's the really sickening thing to say. Who gets ahead in our society? You know, the person that does the right thing, or the person who is the most sneaky, the most ruthless, the person that actually thinks our laws are just a joke.
David, are you concerned about Australia's geopolitical standing, its place on the international stage? Because a lot of people seem to see it as doing the bidding of the United States, being in this confrontation with China. Assange is another aspect of that.
It completely is, that it does worry me a lot. We will never move forward as a country until we take a good hard look at what they euphemistically call the strategic relationship. The idea, and that means we just do whatever America wants. And the idea is that they will look after us, if we ever got invaded. But I mean, that's highly questionable. And I would rather stand on our own. They make us buy their equipment. They use us. Obviously, we don't have a very big army, but it has a very potent effect. And it means that when they go on these expeditions to Middle Eastern countries, it doesn't look like they're acting on their own. So having Australian is powerful for them.
So Donald Trump, he sanctioned the ICC for investigating war crimes in Afghanistan. Israel is now scared that the ICC might investigate them. Do you think that Australia has handled the SAS war crimes adequately? And if not, and I think I already know the answer, but if not, do you think that the ICC should be stepping in to prosecute military officials and politicians involved with that?
I believe the ICC, I believe that was the motivation for the Brereton report. That was the real motivation. I spoke to a senior lawyer back in 2014 and I said, what's going on? There's obviously some big cover-up. There's something strange going on. As I said, we're prosecuting people we shouldn't be prosecuting, and we're not prosecuting the famous guys that need it. And he said, we're worried about the ICC. And I didn't understand at the time. I thought, well, the ICC don't have any jurisdiction in Australia unless it's pretty serious. Well, I didn't realise that it was a lot more, it was serious enough for the ICC. They knew it back in 2014. And everything they've done since, because the ICC can't prosecute you if you have carried out prosecutions yourself. I think they think they're being really clever, because I imagine it's not clear what carrying out prosecutions means. And so if you're carrying out prosecutions yourself for 50 years, then that probably qualifies, you know, or whatever. By the time they'll all be retired. And the reason why the ICC scares them, the ICC has a tendency to go for the leadership. And this is how, you know, spineless our people are. They don't really care about the soldiers doing things wrong or whatever, but they worry that they might be in the frame and they might get for the Hague. And so they need to find some scapegoats fast, and they need to draw it out. And I think that was the really cynical motivation about Brereton, was to get, because unlike the US, we're a signature, this is typical Australia, as going back to Maurice Payne. We can't sign up to these things quick enough. We sign up to anything and we're like, oh, we're such a good nation, you know, we signed up to the ICC. And I think a lot of the time too, people just want to go on junkets to nice sounding, Rome was where the ICC was put together. but they don't really think about what it means to be a member. And now we're, the Americans have of course never signed up to it, and now we're backpedaling really fast. We will be complicit, even though we're a signatory to the ICC, a founding member, and the Americans, Pompeo's absolutely outrageous idea that he was going to put sanctions, that he made the ICC the bad guys, to try to make out that like the ICC were the criminals. Australia, of course, did nothing. And again, this is that creepy thing about, you know, being the beholden to the US. We either need to get out of the ICC or we need to say something about that Pompeo's actions. And they're pretty outrageous. But I think that's the... Unfortunately, you hang around, you know, the bullies long enough and you become like them. And I think the only reason, we even did the inquiries was to keep the ICC off our back. We didn't support the ICC when Pompeo was putting sanctions on them. Oh my God.
Because like you said, these investigations, they literally take years. And you also had the UK inquiry, Operation Northmore, where they're investigating war crimes in Afghanistan. And of course, no one is found guilty.
I think that's another good example. I'm glad you brought it up. I think that's what we're getting in Australia. And unfortunately, all these people who work in the government, they've seen the same playbook. You know, make a big noise about something for long enough, throw enough money, but then make sure nothing ever happens. It's the sort of thing they do with political investigations, you know. Whereas if you only care about public appearances, that sort of thing makes perfect sense. You know, if you're not actually trying to do the right thing, just trying to win elections, of course double dealing and mixed messages and playing one side off another, a bit like the American elections, you know, the partisan politics serves a purpose. And if public perception and opinion polling are your goals, your ultimate goals, why not just mess with the truth the whole time? You know, a trial is really just a way to look good temporarily. And if you have to have a trial but make sure the person gets acquitted, that's a win-win as far as these very cynical, you know, reputation management people would go. And pretty much everything that the U.S. not just the U.S. but all the Western nations is doing in the middle is a sham.
David McBride, thank you so much for your time. It's great speaking with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your great work.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
The United Kingdom, which also invaded Afghanistan in 2001, is also embroiled in its own war crimes scandal. Britain's special forces, also named the Special Air Service, the SAS, were found to be committing war crimes going back many, many years. These war crimes involved many of the same things we just looked at, such as blooding or throwdowns, and were also systemically covered up by the entire chain of command. An inquiry was also launched called Operation Northmore, yet not a single soldier or politician was held accountable. These atrocities were reported on years before when the Sunday Times, in cooperation with the BBC, published internal emails showing that troops in Afghanistan were casually discussing these war crimes among themselves. For example, in late 2010 and early 2011, British Special Forces from D Squadron in the 22nd Special Air Service Regiment conducted several night raids in Helmand Province in Afghanistan. During these nighttime raids, they would regularly execute dozens of unarmed Afghani men, committing the most horrendous of war crimes with complete impunity. On February 16th, 2011, the SAS stormed the house of a man named Saifullah Gharibyar. They executed his two brothers, his cousin, and his father. All his family members had been unarmed and were already in custody at this point when they were murdered. Afterwards, the SAS falsified their operational summary or OPSUM reports, claiming that these men had brandished weapons of some sort. They did this for practically every raid, these throwdowns. The report goes on to detail how British commanders became aware early on of a deliberate policy of executing Afghani civilians, particularly men. In one email published by the Sunday Times, a major in the SAS remarks that there were more bodies than weapons. This clearly indicates that either the weapons had gone missing, or the men were never armed to begin with, and these reports were fabricated or falsified. The numbers literally did not add up. In another email, soldiers casually talk about the latest massacre, indicating how common these occurrences were. The UK's Ministry of Defense claims that a, quote, breakdown of communication, unquote, between the Ministry of Defense and lawyers is the reason that no action ended up being taken. Operation Northmore was set up in 2014 to investigate these crimes, and yet here we are in 2021, and not a single person has been found guilty despite all of these killings. How is that possible? It's extraordinary that none of these investigations, whether we're talking about Operation Northmore or the Brereton Report, have resulted in any successful prosecutions or convictions or even criminal proceedings beginning. How is it that Australian, British, and American special forces get away with murder, literally? The end result of this is that these actions not only disgrace the uniforms of these countries, but also blow a giant hole in the mission these countries allegedly came to accomplish. If their original goal was supposedly to bring peace and stability, this is not it. Executing unarmed men and getting away with murder literally is not nation building or bringing peace and stability and security to Afghanistan. It's a horrendous, brutal occupation that cannot be justified and is ultimately self-defeating. In some cases, when Afghan civilians were executed by special forces, their families were paid compensation by British and Australian troops, who did so without acknowledging any wrongdoing. If you look at the sums mentioned, in some cases it's around $2,000 or $3,000. According to the Sunday Times, in July of 2012, an Afghan mother named Bebe Harasta watched as British SAS shot dead her three sons, Noor, Dean, and Zaire Muhammad, in the courtyard of her own home. They were just farmers. The British then paid her £3,000 and just left. Of course, the British government denies any wrongdoing. And in another instance, reported by ABC, Australian Special Forces killed a man named Bismillah Azadi and his 15-year-old son Sadiq Fallah while they lay sleeping. According to Bismillah's cousin, he found them dead and the bed riddled with bullets. The Australian Special Forces had left some cash with the corpse and left. Is that how much the United States, Britain, Australia think Afghan lives are worth? A few thousand dollars? This is not just repulsive, it's extremely insulting and dehumanizing. Foreign invaders come to Afghanistan, kill Afghan civilians in front of their families, pay them a few pennies, and then just move on to the next village or next town as if they did nothing. And the world stays silent and allows this to continue for decades. Is this it? Anyone with a shred of decency would be shocked and offended by what's going on. And these are just the things that we know of. More recently, there's a bill going through the British Parliament called the Overseas Operations Bill, which is extreme cause for concern. This bill seeks to eliminate accountability for British troops who commit war crimes overseas by introducing a statute of limitation of 5 years after the event has happened, if it's even investigated. This means war crimes, torture, abuses of various kinds would go unpunished, essentially. Not just in terms of the soldiers committing the acts, but all the way up the chain of command. No one would be held responsible. It effectively eviscerates accountability for war crimes and does nothing to prevent them in the future. It's an assault on human rights in the clearest sense and an indication that the British government intends to continue the trend of letting war crimes go unpunished. If there's one thing we've learned from these investigations, it's not just that war crimes have been committed with absolute impunity, and that these horrific practices like blooding and throwdowns are going on, but that there's also been a systemic cover-up going up the entire chain of command. It's really worth thinking about what is more concerning here, the fact that these war crimes have taken place at all, or that military officials and politicians are able to get away with them and escape unscathed after failing to prevent them from happening in the first place and letting them continue when they knew the horrors that were taking place. Honestly, both are equally terrifying and equally unacceptable, most of all to the victims and their families. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration has recently played down one of the main drivers of Yemen's humanitarian crisis, a Saudi naval and air blockade that is preventing fuel and other critical supplies from entering the country, says Chris Gilardi, a writer, in an article published under the heading, As Yemen's Famine Worsens, Biden Does Nothing. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. When President Joe Biden announced in February that he was ending U.S. support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales, Aisha Joman, president of the Yemen Relief and Reconstruction Foundation, phoned her colleagues in Yemen. I was calling them to say there is a light at the end of the tunnel, said Joman, who is Yemeni-American. Not a single person believed it, she said. They knew better. So far, the skepticism of Joman's co-workers has been vindicated. Nearly 3 months have elapsed since Biden's statement, and he has yet to specify what constitutes an offensive operation. It remains unclear what, if anything, his administration has actually done to stop the Saudi Arabia-led military intervention. When asked by Congress recently for updates, Biden's Yemen envoy, Tim Lenderking, claimed ignorance. And this month, the White House announced that it was moving forward with a $23 billion arms sale to the United Arab Emirates, one of the main players in Yemen war. The Biden administration also recently played down one of the main drivers of Yemen's humanitarian crisis, a Saudi naval and air blockade that is preventing fuel and other critical supplies from entering the country. Rather than answer questions about the U.S. support for the Yemen intervention and blockade ongoing since 2015, a State Department spokesperson told Vox that the blockade is not a blockade, quibbling that some food and other supplies are getting into Yemen and that Yemeni authorities are also contributing to import problems. The denial followed comments from Leonard King, who last month attempted to shift the blame for fuel shortages onto Yemeni resistance forces, despite United Nations and press reports pointing to the Saudi blockade as the most immediate cause. The fact that the Saudis determine what gets into Yemen and what doesn't and when, that is a blockade, said Joman, adding that her organization hasn't been able to send medicine to Yemen in over a year. The Biden administration's equivocating and willingness to cover for Saudi Arabia's actions in Yemen and its opaqueness about its own continued involvement in the conflict track with a trend in U.S. policy in the region, one that far predates the Six-Year War. Even though the United States boasts tremendous influence over Yemen, Washington has for decades treated the country as a tool for pursuing tangential foreign policy goals, usually countering terrorism and maintaining warm relations with Saudi Arabia. As the Biden administration continues in the tradition of U.S. non-policy, the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which has been widely considered to be the world's most dire for roughly 5 years, grows more calamitous. 2.5 years ago, Save the Children estimated that around 85,000 children in Yemen under the age of 5 had died of malnutrition, and under current conditions, 400,000 more children could die